Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and we shine a light on the path ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio podcast is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address the problems together rather than merely defend positions. Well, today we're going to talk about clean money. Clean money and filthy lucre. Is there a difference? Well, yes, says our guest this week, Joel Solomon, who calls himself a mission venture capitalist. He's the author of a new book called The Clean Money Revolution, Reinventing Power, Purpose, and Capitalism. And he's also the chairman of Renewal Funds, which is one of the largest mission venture capital funds in North America, investing $98 million in entrepreneurs with organic food, green businesses, and social policies. Money, says Joel, is energy, and the right use of money is akin to the right use of energy. Well, we're at a time when the casino economy, which is where small numbers of people make large amounts of money and large numbers of people subsist on small amounts, Joel points the way toward making the world a better place and not just a bet-whore place, B-E-T-T-O-R, as in gambling. Yeah, I guess you can't see my spelling over the radio. So anyway, we're going to talk about this, and we're going to talk about capitalism. Is it a failed and obsolete system, or can it be used to leverage our resources more resourcefully and use our intelligence more intelligently? Will we be able to return, or maybe it's advanced, to the Native Americans' notion of making our decisions as if they impact seven generations back and seven generations forward? How can we use our financial resources to restore our water, air, soil, and food when so many forces are actually degrading them right now? And can we manage the human ecosystem to reharmonize with the planetary ecosystem? So we're going to address those questions and more as we converse with an individual who has used inherited wealth for the greater good and has coached thousands of others to do the same. Welcome, Joel Solomon.
Thanks so much, Steve. I really am enjoying your use of language and messing with the roots of words. That's excellent.
That's what words are for. You know, this is if we want to create some a different way of thinking, we have to listen to some of the cliches that we've used and just reanimate them and bring them to life, and that gets people's attention. So you created a very interesting term that I'd like to explore: clean money. Clean money. What is clean money, and how and why is money a sacred tool, which is another phrase you used in your book?
You can see that I like to pay close attention to words as well.
Yeah, I could tell.
And yet, clean money is so simple. I was somewhat inspired by the book Dirty Money by Jane Mayer that mapped out a lot of how we got into the pickle we're in politically. For me, it's that I spent a lot of time early in life due to experiences and things I was exposed to. I was diagnosed with a genetic kidney disease. I was told I might not live long. I saw a lot of kind of progressive politics, and my family was involved in things like that. And I grew up in the era where the questioning of capitalism was at least still going on in earnest. Vietnam War, was this war just about making money and getting control of resources and things like that? So I was touched by the movements and the thinking going on in the 60s by some of the, like my mother is a fairly iconoclastic, and she's an artistic photographer who I've seen a lot of emotion and challenge and different kinds of life settings through. So the kidney disease, the kidney cleans the blood. What goes in the blood? Okay, well, that led me into organic food investing. Led me into what I eat, which later turned into investing. And all of this caused me to think a lot about what money had kind of become God. And the main pathway that was there for me as a young white male with privilege was, how do I make $1 billion and then I'll be somebody? And I didn't, it didn't grab me that way. And so to make the story short, with a lot of exposure, reading, thinking, getting in networks and places that talked about these things, I concluded that capitalism, though it could use some serious reinvention, that capitalism has really become the dominant form of exchange in how the world gets managed to a large degree. Not everybody, not everything, but pretty dominant. And that the game needed to be for somebody like myself that got born into a place where I learned about it and I did have opportunities is, okay, how can capitalism, money, and finance be the most powerful force for good rather than just for maximum exploitation? Mm-hmm. So from there you get into, well, how do you talk about money in a different way? There are all kinds of movements that have come up about socially responsible investing, and now we have something called impact investing, which is meant to be, we think about the kinds of companies and the products, and we invest in things that we think are going to make the world better. And I do that for a living now. But as I got into my 60s and realized that despite myself and lots of people working on all kinds of issues, that this freight train was not slowing down, and that we're, with population growth and industrialization technology, we got a heap of trouble on our hands. And if we want to be fulfilling the job of all humans, in my view, which is to be good ancestors for generations that follow us, we need some new ways of handling money and capitalism. So the terms, there's not a great term for it. And after a lot of debate with colleagues and thinking about the book title and things, clean money finally settled in. I didn't like it at first because it's too definitive. It's too black and white. But I realized that we need this kind of use of language to help people think. And so what is clean money? Clean money is money that we're thinking about where it came from, what it did before it got to us. Did it harm people and places? When we hold it and we use it, is it causing damage, or is it supporting regeneration and for things to get better for the long term? And then if we're going to make money, are we doing things that are actually for the good of the whole, or are they just selfish and are just about accumulating wealth for ourselves? So clean money settled in as a pretty stark way to it, you got to think about what it means just because of the two words.
Yes, one of the things, the other things you mentioned in the book is something called the Powell Memo, which we'll get to, which has to do with how an entirely different and opposite meme and way of thinking has taken hold. That, you know, greed is good. That the purpose of capitalism. I'm sure that Milton Friedman's words and work were distorted to come up with this idea that the only purpose of money is to make more money. The only purpose of, right, of an endeavor is to make money. And so I was just reading a piece today on Ayn Rand and how her objectivism philosophy has influenced people who now call themselves Republicans. And somehow they don't find a contradiction between every man for himself and love thy neighbor. Somehow. So I'm just wondering how you mentioned, you thought the Powell memo was important enough to mention, so I just want to give you a chance to speak a little bit about that and then talk about how at a time when this other meme of greed and accumulation and I got mine and too bad about you, how does this new idea of clean money take hold in that kind of field?
I'm glad you touched on the political. Ignore it at our peril. The Powell memo and the study, and then back to Jane Mayer and Dirty Money, yeah. which is a deconstruction and mapping of how that all worked. It was visible earlier, and it looked like some kind of obscure libertarians were going to try to save corporations, and it was just another another of many movements that moved through society. Well, it turned out that there was actually a very systematic and well thought through plan, a strategy for how over some decades that corporate dominance and dominance of the few, in order to exploit mightily and build massive wealth and be masters of the universe, I guess, kind of grew and began to succeed. And I saw this model and what I felt like it was succeeding at, and I thought that it actually, as a model, made a lot of sense, and here's how it did for me. I believe that you can always find how nature works, and that's a good source of some of the principles that might be used for how humans might build society. So if you focus everything at the top and things get top heavy, then an ecosystem won't make it. But if you want to change the way things are and you work on an ecosystemic basis, I took that model when I had the opportunity to work with a high net worth individual who felt she wanted the majority of her funds to be deployed for long-term better future now rather than building some pot of money that would go on hundreds of years in the future just for her family's aggrandizement or something. And so I had the opportunity to use capital in a region in a kind of systemic approach towards how do you make cultural and social positive change through investing, granting, involvement in public policy and politics, and leadership development around personal development skills as well. How can we make great leaders? And that combination, and then working broadly with large dollars, small dollars, building capacity and infrastructure. So I actually lived out a model like that, and I got to shorten my answer here, but I felt a lot of success and I saw the influence of it. So a simple way to say this is progressives or progressive-minded people can do this too. And so Powell memo and some of the writings about how that happened is out there for all of us to read. So let's get smart about doing that a little differently with different value sets.
You know, we have this. We definitely have this individual desire to make a positive difference in the world. Again, when you have the financial resource and the strategic capacity that Lewis Powell and his people had in the 70s and 80s to really bring this rather obscure and remote idea into how people think nowadays. What do you think the trim tab, what's the thing that's really going to make a difference right now to actually shift more people into this notion of, for example, seven generation thinking, that we have to consider our ancestors and what they planted for us, and then we have to consider those that come later. And we seem to have a system that is addicted to a short-term gain. What do you think is kind of is there some kind of idea or phrase or shift that you can articulate that's what we need to gather under or around?
Well, commitment to long-term thinking, and that we need a clean, safe, fair world to live in order to go forward as humanity. So the whole ancestral and seven generation concept is crucial, and we seem to have lost it. We might care about the seventh generation of our bloodline, but that's very limited and selfish and poor thinking. And if you don't consider the whole, it used to be Republicans still had a sense, even conservatives, like employers in small towns and things, they knew that if they didn't treat their employees well enough, and if people were under too much stress, that society could crack apart. And we're seeing the reality of that now, and we're on the edge of it. But what it's done is make those who maybe are more power, I guess I can say, I mean, I really think it comes from fear of some kind, but the greed-based. I believe that I have to ask myself a question, and I encourage others, how much is enough? How much is enough money? Now, the sport and the fun and the pleasure and the human nature to make money, it's a nice reward system for a lot of people, at least psychologically and emotionally. But how can we be a billionaire of good deeds? How could we be a billionaire of love? You know, and I'm not talking about the type our president demonstrates in the U.S. I'm talking about the love of humanity and the love of the future and the love of this incredible Garden of Eden that we've been given part
good.
Of.
We're going to pick up on that thought about love and love of humanity after our break. We're talking with Joel Solomon, who's written about clean money revolution. We'll be back with Wiki Politiki shortly.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hello, Steve Behrman back with our guest on Wiki Politiki, Joel Solomon. Now, it's interesting that you brought up this idea of doing things for the love of humanity, because there's a term that is based in love of humanity called philanthropy. And yeah. So your major area of focus has been in the area of conscious investment. But what about philanthropy? What is the purpose of philanthropy inside of this renewal economy, and what's required to transform philanthropy?
Well, I actually, my lead, my day job, the work that I do to earn money and engage that way is in investing. But I've also been quite involved in philanthropy as well. And more, because I don't have, I'm very comfortable. I'm comfortably affluent, as I say, or I'm wealthy, but it's, you know, there are many scales of wealth out there. So I don't get to do substantial philanthropy, but I did manage a foundation that spent itself down over a short period of time in order to make its value higher. And more interestingly, I've invested in some infrastructures to help philanthropy in general. Something called the Tides Foundation, then modeled in Canada as the Tides Canada Foundation. These are effectively organizations that support hundreds and hundreds of people to give their money away more effectively, solve complex tax and other kinds of issues they need to do to get the money out the door, and might provide program services if they say, I'm interested in X issue. You know, they can go out and build a docket. I care about toxics, you know, and they'll give you ways to do that very smart instead of just kind of randomly. So that for me is the kind of leverage I like. It's fun to give away money. I enjoy it. Give me more money and I'll give away more money. But what I think is more lasting that I can contribute to are effectively business models in the charitable sector that leverage massive amounts of dollars to move potentially. So philanthropy is very important. I've got a chapter in the book on philanthropy. It's a critique of the current philanthropy that basically says tax laws and attempting to hold the family together created most of philanthropy. And then it sometimes is kind of a society tool. I get to go to the fancy events because I buy a table at the, you know, the head table. The big charities are very skillful fundraisers, so everything goes into the big institutions, which can be fairly conservative themselves. And so the kind of philanthropy I'm interested in is the social change type that's actually questioning and thinking about the future and where is there unfairness in the system or things that need to be better paid attention to. So there is and one thing that ties into my day job is that every foundation has an endowment. That is a pot of money that's been given a tax break to go from private ownership into charitable foundation ownership, but you can still control the foundation. And that endowment is invested often and historically was totally invested in some of the most destructive activities you could dream up on the planet. And that comes through stock market investing.
Yeah, sure.
So here are all these foundations, $1 trillion worth in the U.S. and Canada alone. And $1 trillion is invested in pretty damaging and destructive things. And then the proceeds, the earnings are used to try to solve little bits of the problems that have been created through the earnings. And this has been investment philosophy for foundations for almost forever. And in recent times, they're beginning to come to terms with this. Community foundations, well, their job is to support the community. All their money is invested globally. So there's a big movement underway where philanthropy is getting much more interesting and the asset base, and we attempt to sell our product, our fund, which is a collection of organic food companies and environmental technology companies, so that foundations have another alternative. And so this is a growing trend also. If people are paying attention, like Chan Zuckerberg Foundation and Steve Jobs' wife, widow, has created a very large entity, and these people are getting more entrepreneurial with the interface between charitable and investing. Some of that I don't like, some of that I love. So, but we need this kind of innovation and to look at money as the embodied energy of the planet and people and get it doing good things in the world, and the charitable foundation should be first in line.
That's kind of a cradle-to-cradle approach, where you're really looking at where did the money come from before I'm using it, and then how can we I think that's a wonderful idea that I hadn't thought of. I must have missed that, the idea of actually reinvesting, having these endowment funds invest in worthwhile things, and that's a huge amount of money that we're talking about. You also make the distinction between slow money, and I really enjoyed Woody Tash's book and presentation on that topic, slow money and fast money. How would you distinguish those two?
Well, I have to use Woody, who had a big influence on me and still does. He keeps putting out really brilliant thinking. He talks about nature, and he says, invest like an earthworm, and think long term, and think of profit like you would a farmer thinks about their harvests. Some years it goes well, some years it doesn't. Deeply align with what you really believe in. So the slow money concept comes from the fact that Woody points out we've got computers doing most of the transactions on the planet, whether it's currency exchange, looking for, you know, micro shifts in currency or stock market complex formulas. Now we've got the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency versions of this, where there are these esoteric activities going on that have often very little to do with human productivity, but are just betting, just like betting machines. And a lot of the global economy now is doing that. And it goes at highly accelerated speeds, this currency trading and such. So that's money that is got one job, which is just find every nickel, every penny, and just keep accumulate them. Slow money would be more like someone wants to open a community center that's called a cafe, that's got a stage. They're looking at all their products just right. They're buying local. They're doing education. They're doing all kinds of things, and it's a business, and they pay salaries, and they might make some profit on it. It might take it a decade or 20 years. I invested in Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm from. I invested in the first modern coffee that actually made it in Nashville, and we try to think of every single thing we can that makes use of those spaces. We do voter registration every election. We make it available to charities, and money gets made, and over 20 years, it's solid, and we support employees to go out and open next businesses that they want to do. We might be a minority investor. So that's a longer, slower process, more like the way nature works.
Interesting, yes. Because it's really about creating an ecosystem, isn't it?
That's right. And what's the rush? If you've already got enough, I believe we should be using our time to do service and do well in the world. And it's fine if you want to make some more money, but just think about investing in things that matter.
You know, you also had some distinctions about, the classic cliche vulture capitalism as opposed to venture capitalism. And you talk about the difference between, and this also relates to, I think, fast and slow money, that the venture capitalists have learned to be in search of the very, very quick dollar. And so they're willing to abandon projects that may make it over a long term, but over the short term, it's going to take them a longer time to get to liftoff. So you see that as relating to slow and fast money.
I do, and we've attempted to, when we call ourselves Mission Venture Capital, we live on a reputation, we believe, that we're more fair and we actually care, and we're not just jamming everybody to make the quickest possible money they can. We've promised our investors a above market rate of return, and it turns out that this kind of investing can do that. And the people that are so highly speculative and kind of ruthless about their relationships with the entrepreneurs, even the customers, that sometimes that works, and it works spectacularly, but it doesn't always work. And there's a certain kind of resilience, again, back to natural systems. They don't just happen. They don't just snap, pop up out of nowhere and grow gargantuan, and then everybody's happy ever after. So I just say, if you keep going back to natural systems and use it as a lens to look at modern society, you can just one thing after another see where we've gotten out of balance.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true. And I think that one of the other interesting things that I notice is that you have coached other people, and I in the past have worked with Lynn Twist, you know, who wrote I think her book was called The Soul of Money, and it was really about working with people who have money. And you know, there's certainly the issues of not having money. A lot of people have had that experience. There's also the issue of having money and all of the being hit on by people and not wanting people to know that you have money, and then maybe feeling a bit of shame or defensiveness. And how have you it probably has to do with your own transformation in that regard, but say something about bringing people into who have money and who really want to have an impact. Bringing them into kind of a coherence about it, and places where they can put their money.
Well, I got to start on that tough part that you mentioned, which is, let's just think about the fact of how much of capitalism was built on slavery. We should be asking some questions and maybe feeling a little uncomfortable. We should want to know how our money is perpetuating damage and pain. That's legitimate. So that should be the core ethic of spiritual traditions and religions, as far as I'm concerned, is that do unto others as you would have others do unto you is an economic principle in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay to think about this and wonder, did I poison somebody else's child so that I could have this piece of plastic here? Am I going to kill a sperm whale because of it? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. So we do owe a responsibility to think about how things come about. Meanwhile, I don't want to encourage everybody to walk around and feel guilty and ashamed all the time. I want people to take action. I want people to support smart public policies and decent politicians and think about the companies they buy from and the bank they use and the insurance they use and things like that. Can you remind me the second part of that?
Yeah. I was talking about people who have money. Who I know that there's been a breakthrough over the past 30 or 40 years, and some of the, you know, social venture network and some of these networks that really empower people to kind of come out of the closet about having money and then use that money to leverage positive stuff. So I just was talking more about working with individuals like that.
So there's a reality. When you've got money and you make yourself visible, some people describe it as you become like an ATM where everybody wants to come and
yeah.
give you a story and get some money. And the way I described it with the individual I worked with was she didn't want to be public, and she didn't want to deal with all those people looking for money. And so I said, well, I put a tattoo that had a dollar symbol on my forehead and walked around town with it. Because, you know, it was like I was the guy that was open and friendly and writing a lot of checks. So there's definitely psychological and emotional challenges when you have a lot more money than everyone else. I'll go back to my earlier statement. Well, that's legitimate. Should have some questions about it and think about how to be the best person you can if you've been given this unbelievable opportunity. Like, use it. I'm not against people being incented and to be able to have rewards, but I believe that should be then replicated in our own behaviors, that we take more responsibility if we've been given more. So meanwhile, there are something like there's $100 trillion that will pass hands in North America over the next 3 decades from people my age, to people a third my age, you know, to young people. And that money is going to pass just through death. So that's just inherited capital.
Wow.
And that creates, when you wake up one day and your family finally tells you, you've inherited $5 million, $50 million, $500 million, and you're responsible for it, your whole life gets put into a structure and a system and a cultural style that effectively is like a palace with guards around it and those, you know, those Merlins that come and whisper in your ear, but this whole palace guard.
Yeah.
And you become very protected and isolated, and you go to dinner with a group of friends. Do you pay or don't you pay? You know, so there's question after question after question. So there is a deep psychological, emotional, and spiritual reality to have this substance in big concentrated forms, because it did a lot of things before it got to you. It's doing a lot of things right now while we're talking. So I have been, as an heir who started out that way, you know, I had a lot of issues of like, am I like everybody else? Do I have to be different? Do I have to be careful? And these kinds of things. So very few people have sympathy for that problem, and I understand it, which is if only I had the money, you know. But the question I like to ask, and then Dot, what would you do? Like, that's really helpful to have those conversations. Everybody really should consider, once they've gotten past basic security, let's talk about what we should do with money, what we would do with money, what's creative, what's generative, what's going to make the future better. It's a very creative and powerful substance. So working with people that have ended up with, either through making it, but I think where you headed in my mind was more towards those who inherit it.
Yes.
How do we do this? What's our responsibility? Thank you, Steve.
Okay, well, we're going to continue after this break with Joel Solomon talking about some success stories and some other possibilities of how to generate more clean money.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential, so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Okay. Hi, Steve Behrman back with Wiki Politiki. We're talking with Joel Solomon about the clean money revolution. I have to confess, so one of the things I've really been enjoying about our conversation, knowing that you're a resident of Canada right now, I just hear a little bit of that Chattanooga and Nashville in your accent. And so it reminded me that right back there in that neck of the woods in Kentucky, we have two senators, two Republican senators in Kentucky, who are now advocating and pushing agricultural industrial hemp. And in fact, as part of the new farm bill here in the States, if it gets passed, and it looks like it will, industrial hemp will be fully legal and free of the drug schedule restrictions and so on. Now, everything I've read about hemp, and my wife is very a great advocate of agricultural industrial hemp, it seems to be an excellent way to restore the soil and revitalize rural America. Do you see, is this on your radar? Do you see the possibilities of this?
Yes, I agree with all of that. Not being an agricultural scientist, you know, I mean, I've read this and been aware of it for many years, of the beneficial uses of hemp in this way, and I do believe it's true. I don't know if it can revolutionize, you know, modern agriculture completely, but it certainly can help, and there are many, many beneficial qualities. I've chosen not to get involved there for just – it's just not the investment area that I'm focused on, but I pay attention, and I'm excited to see if that can actually roll out and make a big difference.
And what about the climate change issues right now? I mean, and, you know, it certainly seems that we're at a point where, you know, perhaps even if we were following the Paris agreements and so on, we would still fall short of avoiding some of the more disastrous consequences. How can clean money now begin to have an impact in the area of climate change?
Yeah. Well, fossil fuels are precious. They took hundreds of thousands of years to create. They should be used for very special things. We don't need to burn them to move ourselves around or heat our homes. We've got better technologies now. I'd like there to be fossil fuels around in 10,000 years because they can do some fairly miraculous things. And now we know that renewables are legitimate, functional. You can make money. You can power a lot of things with renewables. So let's start shifting massive capital, deploy as quickly as possible, supported and encouraged by public policy. However, where's the fly in this ointment? Concentrated interests and the money-making machinery that fossil fuels are. So then you move to public policy. And climate gets to be it's as if this is one of the crassest things I can imagine about high IQ, highly accomplished people that are willing to make the case that climate's not relevant, that it's all a hoax, and that we should just keep on partying. This is going to be looked back on as one of the saddest periods in human history, if we make it through it.
If there's anybody to look back on it.
If there's anybody to look back on. So then you move to money. Well, I just gave you know, let's overhaul the entire economy for cleaner, greener, and more fair. And let's start with energy, and then let's move on to plastics and consumer goods and how we make things. Let's then move to the built environments, one of the biggest contributors to climate because of inefficiency and heat loss and things like that. Then let's move to agriculture. Maybe modern agriculture, industrial agriculture, is the single greatest contributor to the effect on climate over the years. And now with 7.6 billion of us going on 10 billion, that could just keep accelerating. Soil losses, side effects, all kinds of side effects from it, but just simply turning the soil and removing the perennial base of plant life and annually plowing and starting again and then pouring fossil fuel-based supplements to make everything work. So there's money involved in everything I've just said. And so there's money involved in keeping it how it is. And that would continue to benefit those who control all that. There's money involved in changing it. And that would benefit potentially more of us.
Now, of course, I'm guessing, I have no idea what the demographics are of people who are listening to the show, but I'm guessing that many of the people listening don't have the personal wealth to invest. How can ordinary people in their daily life move forward this clean money revolution?
So let me start with just naming the structural kind of horrible reality that we live in right now, which is probably half the population doesn't know if they can make ends meet, maybe more, just doesn't know if they can make ends meet. And they have to do whatever they need to do to look after their children and their well-beings, keep a roof over their head, get a decent education, give their kids a better chance. What can they do is one set of answers. And all I will say is I understand that they've got to first look out for the survival and well-being of their families and themselves. And if they've got more energy after that, then they could, there's small things they could do. But the real focus of this conversation is those of us with the privilege, the power, and the concentrated resources in which you keep on moving up that food chain and you move, you know, for example, Occupy was built around the concept of the 1%. Well, 1% in the USA is 3 million people. 3 million people are who we're talking about. That's a lot of people that have ownership of, I don't know what the number is, but let's maybe it's 7 million now or something of net worth to be in there, 10 million. So those people, we people, can do a lot. And then middle class can do a certain amount because we shop. We can decide what we buy, where we buy. We have generally some kind of savings. What's our pension fund? What are they invested in? We have now the ability, they're calling it democratized investing. I'm not fully comfortable with that term and what it means, but now people that are not millionaires are legally allowed to take speculative risk and invest in small companies, and that's called crowdfunding. So you can go on any number of crowdfunding sites now and make investments in things you believe in. You got to choose where to bank. You got to choose who to do business with in every single transaction. And you got to choose how wasteful you're going to be. You got to, you know, do you want to have to go make double the money so you can throw away more stuff? Or do you want to be smarter about buying less things and reusing better and how to fix them and not just end up in the landfill? So that's, you have to go through the scale of people living in abject poverty to people living in grotesquely indulgent, just kind of bleeding money out the back door kinds of lives. And so everybody's got their part to play. The people that are listening to this radio show, and I heard your interstitials and what you guys are about, and anybody doing that probably is got a job and has some amount of money. Well, let's say the majority do. So we're talking to a middle class to upper class audience, and I won't repeat the list. I'll just say, I will just speak directly to you who are listening to this and say, take into deep consideration voting with your dollars. You are making a choice with every single dollar. Just make it better. Just keep getting better. This is not, doesn't have to be the hero's journey. Just keep doing better.
You know, and I think everybody can do that. My wife, Trudy, she pretty much buys organic food. And if they have corn that's not organic, she lets them know. If it was organic, I would buy it. So it's a combination of making a stand, as you say, on voting with your dollars. And you can also vote, as you said earlier, where's your pension fund money invested? What products are you buying? Are you supporting the Koch brothers? You know, are you supporting nefarious things because you don't know that the product that you're buying is owned by a company that's doing nefarious things? There's a lot we can talk about in that regard, but I wanted to get to you know, something even more more practical, and that is, given the renewal funds and these ventures that you've managed, I know you have a number of success stories. Why don't you share the story of a business that came about on clean money and is continuing to serve its community and do well?
Yeah. At this point, we have an era of invention where in every different sector of the economy, there are people who see the financial opportunity that actually aligns with what they believe in or what they think the market will believe in and other people will believe in if they're just being expedient. I've got some better known examples, like we were early investors in seventh generation non-toxic household products, Stonyfield Farm Yogurt, the first organic and super, like truly still healthy yogurt rather than chemical soup. But I want to talk about our most recent investment because it touches on a lot of the topics we've covered. It is a food traceability software and technology process. Mm-hmm. That means that when a big fast food chain or a restaurant or a grocery store has an incident with actually, like happens sometimes where some people die from the food going bad or they, you know, something bad that happened at a farm, they end up having to shut down like a huge geographic region because they don't know if every restaurant got that same supply. You know, they it's just kind of a chaotic system now, and a lot of damage gets done to farmers, to the middle people, to, you know, that kind of thing. And in technology's got many good sides to it. And in this case, these people have a product which can instantly track and say which farm the bad eggs came from, even down to often which animal. Mm-hmm. And pretty instantly, because there's a data collection part to the business. They've recently announced they're going to team up with blockchain and they're going to validate and verify. And eventually, what will come from this product is a phone swipe, where I look at a barcode, and I know which farm. I can read a story about those farmers and what their values are. So. These kinds of opportunities are available to us. If that works, I can tell you that we were followed in our investment by one of the largest food companies in the world, who had not historically been known for this kind of care and attention, but they're doing it because it's practical. There's nothing, you don't have to have clean money values. You just understand it's more effective to be able to not, you know, get damaged by a bad food incident. So it's just another example of the many ways that we're going to build an economy that is kinder, gentler, and more intelligent and more long-term thinking so that we can have great, 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 great grandchildren.
Well, I like the metaphor of that Bruce Lipton and I used in our Spontaneous Evolution book, which is the caterpillar transforming into the butterfly. And during that process, there is a lot of chaos. There is a lot of caterpillar parts falling apart before the butterfly actually comes together. And, you know, you're actually funding and fueling the imaginal cells of this new organism that, you know, where this information is being used really for the betterment of all. And incidentally, it actually saves millions and millions of dollars to the food company by being able to track where this who the bad chicken was, or whatever
That's
they're
right.
doing. And also to actually let people see where food comes from, to be able to read up on the farm that actually produced that. And there's much more of a demand right. these days for organic food and so on. We're coming to the end of our conversation, I'm sorry to say. Is there anything that you would like to leave the listener with and perhaps let people know, once again, reiterate how best to get your book, The Clean Money Revolution?
We now have enough information to know that we face some pretty grand challenges, unlike previous generations could even conceive of. We really have a moral and ethical obligation and a practical one, that this point of our job is to be sure that future generations have it at least as good, if not better, than we have. If we live by that ethic and we bring it into the pragmatic of our money and what we do with it and how we hold it, we have a chance. We have a chance to create a wonderful future for everyone.
Well, thank you. What a great guest you've been, Joel Solomon. He's the author of The Clean Money Revolution, Reinventing Power, Purpose, and Capitalism. He's the chairman of the Renewal Funds. And this is Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. Until next week, thank you. And may the farce be with you. Thank you. And thank you, Joel.